Greetings and welcome to another edition of AUHSD Future Talks. I'm your host, Michael Matsuda, the superintendent of the Anaheim Union High School District. And as our 7,000 plus podcast listeners know, that this show is dedicated to the future of education. And more than ever, I think that there's a lot of discussion about the misalignment of education to the world of work and to careers and higher ed and beyond. So today joining us is a very special guest, Stephen Bushi, who is the director of the North American Google Education Sales Team. And Stephen was one of the founding team members to bring Chromebooks to the education market, which have become the number one device in K-12 education spaces. And he is currently involved with the launching and bringing the Google Cloud platform to researchers and higher ed. So, Stephen, welcome to our little show.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Yes, and it's awesome to have you as a thought partner. I've noticed that you graduated from Brown University. Earlier, you said you were a guy from Iowa and had this imposter syndrome. Let's talk a little bit about who you are and how you became part of this amazing company, Google.
Yeah. Well, you're probably looking at, it sounds like you did your homework, that I don't have a background in computer science or engineering. And when I studied at Brown, I was mostly in liberal arts, taking classes around French and international relations. But it's interesting, you know, reviewing the profiles that you all have set up around graduates, it's those critical thinking, those communication skills that have actually been really helpful for me in my current role. And fun fact, so when I was graduating from college, we were having a recession in the United States, and I applied to a rotation program at Google and was rejected. It's like, oh no, this is where I want to work. What happened? And it's funny how life kind of comes around in full circle. And it was through a guy that I met from school, Danny, who happened to be working at Google. And I had already started a new job at a research IT research consulting, which when I first started there, it's all about opportunity. I've always heard is luck equals preparedness. So when I first started this research consulting company, they had different practices for sales and supply chain and IT. And they put me on IT. And I was like, why did they put me on IT? I have no IT background. But then I started learning about cloud computing, applying the skills around critical thinking and research that I learned in college. And then a year later, my friend Danny, who I had met at Brown, said, hey, there's a job at Google, and it happens to be working on the IT space in cloud computing. At the time, Los Angeles was one of the big implementations of, you know, Google and Gmail and Calendar. And he said, our education group is growing. Would you be interested? I said, yeah, you know, I after college, I had taught some adult ESL learners or English language learners, and I loved it. I think education's fascinating. Now I have this background in IT research that I didn't have before. And it all came together. And now I've been here 14 years later, still working on education because it is such an amazing space to work in. I do believe that it has the power to transform people's lives like my own, growing up in Iowa and now living in New York City. It's thanks to my education. So it's great to be here.
It is exciting times. And I think that your life story, your career story is really one about what we're doing is really focused on what we call whole child education, the five C's, critical thinking and collaboration, communication. And it demonstrates how important that liberal arts background is in navigating these spaces, right? Because people, you know, downplay the need for liberal arts in, you know, the STEM world that we're living in. So some people call it STEAM now, right? The A, the arts. And I think your career trajectory has demonstrated that. Let's cut to the chase here because, you know, we and Google and some other partners are sponsoring a K-12 AI Education Summit coming up in March. And we really want to talk about what that is. Why do you think that, why is Google involved with this? And why do you think we need a K-12 space?
It's a great question. And I'm really excited that Google is partnering with you all on this because I do think AI has the power to transform education in ways we haven't seen before. And I think about the days when I was in school, going back to my days in Iowa, I remember I was not very good at geometry. And that was a time too where, you know, you'd call up a friend at night And if it was past 9 p.m., the parents like, nope, you're not calling. And so, of course, I had waited until 9:30 to do my homework. And there was a problem I just could not understand. And I wish that I had had that opportunity to have a little tutor on the side. And that's what AI actually allows us, is that at any time and anywhere, you will now have someone that is a tutor that can help explain things to you and give you feedback. And I look back, I think the way that technology has continued to grow and support students and teachers over the years has been amazing. I mean, I wish I would have had Google Docs when I was in school. I didn't have that either. But now we have this ability to collaborate in real time. And I view that AI really is the next big area where it's going to allow us to open up more personalized learning. So as opposed to you saying, here is the same assignment, which happened to me when I was in school, which they would take to the photocopier and say, everyone, you're doing these worksheets and everyone gets the same worksheet. Now we can start to have AI to customize and say, hey, you know, Stephen, this problem is better suited for you versus Mike, this problem is better suited for you. And it can really help us develop our strengths and our weaknesses.
What do you say to critics? And there are a lot of them. There's right now, I think the country's kind of education community is sort of divided, but who say, well, AI is really going to dehumanize education when young people need that human contact and the human connection more than ever.
It's a good point. And I think that it reminds me, I was in Newark Public Schools in New Jersey last fall, and we were talking about AI, and there was a teacher who raised his hand. He said, I want to give a story that when I was teaching here, I had a student that came up and said, I didn't have a father in my life. And you have essentially become that father to me. You as my teacher have been helping guide and coach and advise me. And he said that was because we had a human connection, because I understood that student and he understood me and we cared about each other and I understood what made him tick and he trusted me and we were vulnerable with each other. And I think that there is so much opportunity because we want students to have that experience with teachers across multiple different classrooms. But in reality, there's a lot that stands in the way of grading tests and preparing syllabi and recognizing there's 20 other 9 students in that class we need to support. And so the more that we can take away some of that rote work or the work that takes teachers' time that doesn't allow them to foster that connection with the student, I think is actually really important. So I would view that AI is a tool actually to foster that human connection and get rid of some of the stuff that we don't need to spend human time on to make sure that students really have that personalized experience in the classroom and can connect one-on-one with folks.
So one of the, I think, main benefits, immediate benefits to teachers with these AI tools is to make their jobs more efficient, right, in terms of saving time on those rote things like inputting grades or even grading itself, right, and giving summaries of where students are at. I know that you probably do a lot of traveling and you have a lot of antenna out there. Is that really the way to lead with districts and schools to get teachers to understand how it's going to make their job easier?
I do think, and one of the pieces that we've talked a lot about is putting human in the loop. And you've probably seen it where if someone's going to just take something, put it into AI, and then deliver that as their assignment or deliver that as their lesson plan or deliver that as their performance feedback, it's not going to be that great because really it's a great way to get started, but we still need to be able to double check. We know these humans much better than the computer knows them. And how do we then use that as a starting point, but we still have the human in the loop, so to speak, to check it and ensure that it's correct. It still saves us a lot of time, but I think that you're right. Starting with the educators and making it easier for them and allowing them to try things out. In fact, I even encourage people to say, look at AI of how you can use it in your personal life before even bringing it to the classroom. You know, an example that I had one of my colleagues do is they put in all the ingredients they had in the refrigerator that are going to go bad. And they said, what can I make from this list of ingredients? Has nothing to do with teaching a student in the classroom, but it allows us to get more familiarity with AI. And then once you have that, then bring it into the classroom and then bring it in with students. And so I think that if folks can have the time to play around and try things and see where it saves them time or where it doesn't. And what's not really a useful tool, then don't use it. But I like your approach there, and I agree with it, that it's important for educators first to start with the tool and see where it could be beneficial for them.
From the student standpoint, Stephen, what do you say to students using Bard or chat and just, you know, and this is where I think some of the AP teachers are concerned that, hey, they're just going to get, you know, they're going to cheat, right?
Yeah.
Bring that stuff in. What do you respond, or how do you respond to that concern?
It's a very good question. And it's interesting. Stanford just did a study, and I was speaking with their head of their research unit there. And they had done a study saying that before all these generative AI tools, about 70% of students were cheating. And they redid the study, and after the generative AI tools, 70% of the students were cheating. So there was cheating before, there's going to be cheating after. But I think to that question is, and I think you and others have said it very well too, is could we view the calculator as a way of cheating? And there's times to use it and times not to use it. And so I think if we can allow and say, hey, it's a tool for what we need to accomplish, but just using that tool by itself and not understanding how it works, that's probably not a good usage of the tool. You know, I still want to know how to do basic algebra and do, you know, addition, subtraction, but I'm going to use a calculator for the big numbers because it makes my life a lot easier and I don't have to sit there and carry the one. Similarly, I could see where generative AI could be really helpful in pressure testing a paper and putting it in there and say, hey, argue three counterpoints to what I just said in my thesis. And then how do I want to address those in my paper? So I think it'd be a very helpful tool, but you also have to know when to use it and what are the limits of that tool. And so I do think that it'll be rely a lot on how our teachers setting up the lessons, and that's how will it be used as a tool to cheat, or will it be used as a tool to help students learn even more effectively?
You had mentioned, you know, the possibilities of AI tutors, right? You know, that a tutor teaching you how to use geometry, right? Isn't it really about the tool helping you come up with the right questions or the prompts, rather than giving you the answer, right? As a tutor would do. Tutor is challenging you with prompts. Where are we in terms of that type of AI tool, which is not going to give you the answer, but it's going to teach you how this process is iterative, like writing an essay. You have to edit over and over. Isn't that what we're getting at with these AI tools?
Yeah, and I think you raise an important point that as we bring new tools, it also means understanding how to use them effectively. Just like with the graphing calculators, it took a little while to understand all the functions and all the different gadgets that were available through the tool. And fascinatingly, I was on a panel last October in Nashville with a researcher at Vanderbilt. He actually works on their strategic planning as well. And he is teaching a course on Coursera on prompt engineering. Has 100,000 plus students, but it's all about, here's a new tool. How do we use it effectively? How do you ask the right questions? And I agree with you that some of the most effective AI tutors are going to be those that don't just give the answer, but help walk through that process. And for example, one that we've been working on embedded into practice sets, which is a component of Google Classroom, is looking at a math problem and seeing, okay, a student gets to a certain line where maybe they do their order of operations wrong. Can the tutor spot that and say, hey, walk me through that line. Why did you do this or do that? But now let me refer you back to this video, which talks about you need to do this in order of operations and follow this in this step in order for it to be correct. And I think that you're right. It's not just giving the answer. It's walking through that process.
You know, the marketer Seth Godin said that AI tools are going to make mediocrity obsolete in the workforce. What do you think he meant by that in terms of extending this conversation into preparing kids for the workforce?
It's a good question. My hunch is that he says that tools or activities are going to be just rote activities of checking a box or filing a paper or, you know, the digital equivalent of that may not be as important anymore. And now it's going to be much more about those five C's that you mentioned and applying. Okay, I can get a lot of people to come up with something via AI, but how do I use critical thinking to see what are the holes in that? How did we check? And in fact, it's funny, one of the court cases, I can't remember which one it is off the top of my head, but they had filed a brief in the court and they'd used AI and it pointed out some fictitious or called out some fictitious precedents that didn't exist. And so they now had to go back into the court system. So yeah, critical thinking is very important still.
Well, you had mentioned though, in this Coursera class, you know, where 100,000 engineers are learning how to prompt these tools. I mean, I think that isn't that what he's talking about, that the world of work is going to expect higher productivity and more efficiency using these tools. It's going to make you better at what you do.
Yeah, I do think it's exactly it. And it's like what we were mentioning earlier of how can we, for example, save people time in the classroom by having to do everything from 0 to 100? How can they start at 50 and be able to get to 100 and save them that time? Just like you go to the grocery store and, you know, sometimes you want to make a full cookie, chocolate chip cookie. They're going to go buy the flour and everything. And sometimes you just want to get the peel and bake ones because you say, hey, that's good enough for me. And it's going to save me a little bit of time. So what I like is it's hopefully going to give people flexibility, and that flexibility will allow them to think about how can I provide the best effort and the best, using my skill set, the best product, and where do I need to come in that process?
Are you seeing a lot of people use these tools in the workforce now? And is that going to be the expectation of the next generation?
I do. We see people within Google using Bard and other tools, our Duet AI in our Workspace product, which is AI tools on top of Gmail and Calendar and Docs. I use them quite a bit to help me figure out and generate images, to think about synthesizing documents. It's actually been really helpful, too, for my teammates. You know, some of them, for example, one I mentioned the other day, I said, hey, I realized that you're really good at putting together very robust and in-depth emails. But now I challenge you to think about when you're going to communicate to your boss's boss, how do you take that email and condense it into three sentences while getting the same point? It's like, why don't you try AI? See what it says. It might give you some good ideas. And then you start to see how it's developing those emails, and it might help you in your own skill development. So there's a lot of opportunity for us to use it both in our daily lives, so within school, within work. And I think you're right that those that can use it within work are saving a lot of time.
So one of the questions that are superintendents and education leaders are beginning to ask at this early stage is that these are very powerful tools and we're using it, kids are using it, teachers are using it, but they're concerned about the cost, right? And are there, you know, in the spaces that you operate, are folks beginning to talk about that? How are we going to address the cost of accessing these tools? And might we also, I mean, inadvertently create sort of a gap between low-income and higher-income people that can afford these tools?
Yeah, the digital divide. It's an important question. And it's tough, too, because some of these AI tools, as you've seen, take a lot of compute. You know, if you look at NVIDIA's stock, it is going way up because you need GPUs in order to process all these AI prompts. And I think back, it is something that we need to think about and we need to pay attention to. And I do think back, you know, even 20 years ago, we had the same question of bringing computers into the classroom and say, oh, these are going to be expensive. How do we do this? We realized, though, that to your point, in order to prepare students for the workforce, they need to be able to use them effectively. And then as you realize through the pandemic, it was super helpful that we had, you know, students with technology, because I can't imagine doing a class during the pandemic on a 1-800 dial-up or dial-in line where you'd state your name after the tone. Thank goodness we had things like Google Meet and other video conferencing projects. But it comes down to that as we have more technology, how do we both make that technology cheaper? And then also, how do we think about where do our budgets change in order to afford the technology? And other things, for example, we know that when people are bringing in laptops, they start to say, well, what can we, for example, take that we have in textbook format and turn it into e-formats? And maybe that would be an opportunity to be able to save some money or using open educational resources, OERs. So I imagine that will continue as we think through the adoption of technology is what do we need in order to make our students successful? And then how do we think about the trade-offs while also driving down the cost of the technology as well?
So in this big summit in Anaheim on March 1st and 2nd, there are about 24 states represented, and even Canada is coming. There's something like 65 districts. What do you advise participants that are coming in? What would you advise them to think about as they participate in this conference?
I say come in with my overarching word is curiosity. I think that there's a lot. You brought up some of the potential cons around cheating and plagiarism. There's also some of the potential benefits around personalized learning and giving educators and students time back so they can be even more effective. And in reality, there's a swirl around all these pros and cons. And I think coming in with a sense of curiosity and wanting to learn about how are people using this? How are they putting the right guardrails in so that it's used effectively and safely and privately? That would be my biggest recommendation. And then the other piece is try it. You know, I think that's the most important thing. You probably see it. Someone's like, I don't like that kind of food, or I don't like that. You say, well, have you tried it yet? Yeah. And you try like, oh, actually, this is kind of nice. I didn't like it, you know, when I added it to this dish, but when I tried it here, it was really good. And I could see the same for AI, that some people might say, hey, you know, the image generation stuff, not for me, but you know, the document and the creative process of trying to help me start up a presentation, really helpful. And that's what people need to do, is stay curious and try it. And we'll start then with that. To develop best practices and sharing those out. And that's why I'm really excited about this conference, because I know people are already starting to do that. And now is the opportunity to say, hey, here's what works for me, here's what hasn't, and how we can continue to learn from each other.
Yeah, I think it's just going to be an awesome gathering. And many teacher leaders are coming, as well as superintendents. So we're really excited to be part of that and hosting it with Google. And Stephen, looking forward to your presence there and your talk. And is there any other closing advice that you want to give to our audience?
I'm very excited to see you all. Thank you for including us. And advice is, try it and stay curious.
All right, Stephen. Thank you so much.
See you soon.